Well, as you know, Canon Brian King is really the most major and pivotal figure of any of the clergy who've ever been here at St. Peter's for three reasons. He got the parish out of the mire of debt it had been got into by the Reverend William Ronaldson when he built this church in 1882. He was, secondly, a very well-known and respected community figure, widely known beyond the boundaries of the Anglican parish, or the Church of England as it was then known. And thirdly, because, of course, he introduced the great change in terms of the churchmanship, which has been the predominant style of this parish ever since. Remember his dear old dad, also Brian King, had been the rector of St. George's in the East and had sparked off the ritual riots that would determine the second phase of the Oxford movement, the so-called ritualist heroic phase. Well, in Brian King's time, he was here from 1892 to 1911, mission work began in the area that we now call St. Kilda in Musselburgh. This was called the Thorbury Mission, and that's the point of Edward Woodhouse, as remembered in that stained glass window. He was the curate tasked to get on with that job primarily. And he was assisted by Brian King's son, the amazing Vincent Brian King, who would later be ordained to become the great social worker priest of the Diocese of Dunedin, rejoicing under the wonderful title of chaplain to public institutions. It means he looked after jail and the hospital and the benevolent institution, and he founded a kind of city mission operation in Fallow Street there. Remember, he's the guy who said it's very helpful in my job to have a knowledge of jiu-jitsu when you go into some of the more difficult areas of Dunedin in the course of my ministry. So the Thorbury Mission began to pick up speed, later called the St. Kilda Mission. They conducted services at first in the Thorbury School, then they had services in the St. Kilda Town Hall. Land was purchased and a committee was formed, and they prepared to open a church building in St. Kilda. And when Brian King retired in 1911, he was succeeded by the amazing Father Daring Evans, thought to be an Anglo-Papalist, very extreme in his churchmanship. He'd come out to New Zealand in 1910 with a great mission of help. The Anglican Church felt it was slipping a bit, and so it determined to bring a team of missioners out from England to try and stage a mission every Anglican parish in the country. Well, Daring Evans had been sent down south, but he came back here and became the vicar of St. Peter's in 1911. And he was a kind of very energetic, well-organised kind of a guy who was used to pressing the start button on things. So it was in his time that the building that came to be called Holy Cross St. Kilda was built. It was supposed to be a mission hall based on what he had seen somewhere in London. And later it would become designated as a church. And there's that amazing photograph taken in 1912 of the official opening. And Daring Evans, it's a pontifical high mass, is acting as the deacon, and he's got Bishop Neville dressed up in a chasuble, maniple, and episcopal mitre. Of course, the reality was that Neville had played down his high churchmanship quite a lot at the start of his episcopal ministry here. Remember, Jenner, the first bishop here, had been not allowed to take up his post because of his ritualistic tendencies. Neville was like that, but he just had to play it quietly. By this stage in 1912, he was the primate of all New Zealand. He didn't have to defer to anybody, so he could come out of the closet, as it were, on this score. And after the opening of that church, now there was a well-established pattern of services going, serviced by the clergy from St. Peter's. Well, in 1914, Daring Evans moves off to Baltimore in the United States, and a very, very well-attended Anglo-Catholic parish, and he married a millionaire's daughter. Her father had been very involved and was a generous patron to the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, New York. As she had intense mystical visions of Our Lord and Our Lady, which were published under the encouragement of her spiritual director, a member of the Society of St. John the Evangelist, and their marriage, their nuptial mass, was presided over by two bishops of the Episcopal Church who were all her relatives. He never stayed in one place for very long. He just moved at regular intervals, really itchy feet. Well, he was followed here at St. Peter's by Father Mortimer, who'd grown up in Shirley in Christchurch, And interestingly enough, he was the son-in-law of Father Burton. The priest had been brought into St. Michael's Christchurch to change the world, and boy did he do that. He turned St. Michael's into what it's become, the premier Anglo-Catholic shrine of New Zealand. Half the congregation left and a lot more came. And so Mortimer was very clear in where he was coming from in his churchmanship. He'd married Burton's daughter, and he was here until 1920. And in his time, in 1917, he presided over the decision to allow Holy Cross to become a parish in its own right. I might add, he incidentally did Holy Cross a bit of favour. A lot of the choir stormed off because of Mortimer's ritualistic tendencies, and a lot of them went to Holy Cross and reinforced the beginnings of their choir there. Well, Mortimer died of consumption. He had TB very badly. Maybe it wasn't such a good idea to come here to be the vicar of Caversham. Remember that article in the ODT recently about that huge chimney on South Road where the gasworks were? There was other gasworks down there, of course, and the railway shunting yards would also have been a major source of pollution. So, Mortimer died in 1920. Now, an incident occurred, well, a developing situation throughout the 1920s perhaps helps to explain the relationship of some ambivalence and tension that's often existed between the two parishes of Holy Cross and St. Peter's. People in St. Clair wanted there to be Anglican presence. They petitioned and approached both Holy Cross and St. Peter's for an alteration of the parish boundaries so that the developing Anglican presence there would fall within the boundaries of Holy Cross St. Kilda. Now, in the fascinating history of Holy Cross St. Kilda, which is posted on their website, it suggested that this was because of a fear of the ritualistic tendencies of this parish. I think that's only a small part of the answer. The answer is to be found in the Caversham Project itself, which, in its ground-up assessment of what went on in the life of the suburb, points out that in those days, St. Kilda had a higher proportion of skilled working-class people and white-collar workers than Caversham did. And also, because of the cheap land, young couples were moving there to start families. It was a really go-ahead suburb. So in other words, there was more of a sense of commonality between St. Clair and St. Kilda than there was with Caversham and South Dunedin. And I think it's this class basis and occupation basis that explains the desire to be linked up in this way. Well, St. Peter's Caversham resisted bitterly that, insisted that St. Clair would remain within its boundaries, and in the late 20s, of course, the matriarchs of St. Clair purchased land in Hodges Crescent, bought the redundant Catholic Apostolic Church and put it there, and St. Peter the Less got underway. Of course, in 1930, there was a major showdown when the parish tried to, or St. Peter the Less tried to assert its autonomy and independence, and Canon Button said, no, this will only ever be a chapel of ease for the very young and the very old. And there was a major reverberation and blowback against that. The Guild of St. Peter the Less dissolved itself. That was the major fundraising thing. Members resigned off vestry, and wounds were created that weren't healed until about a decade later in Archdeacon Pywell's time. Well, looking for other points of commonality between the two parishes of Holy Cross St. Kilda and St. Peter's Caversham, Canon Webb, who was the second vicar of Holy Cross, was very interested in Eastern Orthodoxy and got very involved in the life of St. Michael's Fingal Street. He took services for them there, and on high days and holy days, some of the Orthodox folks would worship at Holy Cross St. Kilda. In the late 1960s, that favourable sociology of St. Kilda began to change, and Neil Hanson, in one of his AGM reports, says, look, there's fewer family units living here now, it's more flats and single people, lots of transient people on the move, there's less of a solid base to operate the parish off. And also, of course, as the late 60s and early 70s began, the church was facing strong headwinds from that very strong cultural shift we're living through now of a turn of New Zealand society against Christianity and the church. The next three vicars of Holy Cross St. Kilda would be people who had come from this parish. Roger Taylor, who was vicar there from 1970 to 1977, had been the vicar here from through the 1950s and the early 60s. Des Irwin had been a son of this parish. And then finally John Teal went straight from being vicar here for a long time to his last semi-retirement parish of Holy Cross St Kilda. Well, one final note, I'll skip the bits about the stained glass windows. It refers to the Woodhouse window being damaged by vandalism in the late 1970s. Kevin Casey told me that window's been expertly repaired, so now we know when that happened. Amazing to believe that Holy Cross St Kilda was left unlocked at night up until the late 1970s. Through that time it was plagued with a spate of vandalism and thefts, and it was locked at night thereafter. Well, that's enough for now.